Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, December 27th, 2008. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. Over the last 18 months, it has become clear to all but the most delusional people that Lyndon LaRouche is the most accurate forecaster in the world. Since July 25th, 2007, when he reported on an international webcast that the financial system has crashed, a growing number of people in governments worldwide are following his analysis closely, and there are an increasing number of officials in and around governments who are studying his proposals for a new Bretton Woods monetary system. With a new administration coming to power in Washington, D.C. in less than a month, and the global economy disintegrating at an accelerating rate, 2009 will be a year of decision. Will governments, particularly those identified by LaRouche in his four power proposal, Russia, India, China, and the United States, establish a new Bretton Woods based on the principles of the American system of physical economy and reintroduced by Franklin Roosevelt with the original Bretton Woods Agreement of 1944? Or will the predatory financial forces allied with the City of London, the old Anglo-Dutch liberal empire, instead prevail, ensuring the plunge of humanity into a new dark age? Joining us on the program today will be Lyndon LaRouche and his wife Helga Zepp LaRouche to provide us with both insights and marching orders on what we must do to assure a victory for humanity in 2009. Lynn and Helga, welcome to the LaRouche Show.
Hi.
We're here.
Okay, so Lynn, I just want to start by identifying that even the usual end-of-the-year analysis in the financial press is acknowledging that the unending bailout by Paulson and the 0% interest rates of Bernanke are having no positive effect on the economy. Where do things really stand now with the global economy?
Well, really, you've got two things going on. You have hyperinflation, which is still continuing in terms of the magnitude of obligations outstanding. And the bailout, of course, is simply increasing that. On the other hand, you have a collapse of purchasing power at the lower end of the consumer. So this is causing a deflationary effect, which is temporary, in the current market. Now, what happens as you will get to a shortage of goods, you will then get a surge back to a obvious hyperinflationary plunge like Germany in 1923. This is not exactly the same thing as 23, because in 23, you had the Germany was under the absolute control of the treaty agreement of Versailles. And therefore, they had an artificial box around Germany, on Germany's borders, which caused a somewhat different process that is occurring now. But if you would take into account the fact that you have an international system now, across borders, and with a much larger inflation, you have actually this dualism of a temporary collapse in prices because of the flooding of the market with currency and the shortage of purchasing power. On the other hand, you have, again, a hyperinflationary process in terms of outstanding obligations. So what you're dealing with this particular form of breakdown, which is like 23, except with this one difference, that you don't have this border circumstance that you had around Germany in 1923.
Well, there have been articles by people such as Ambrose Evans Pritchard in the Daily Telegraph who say that we are risking hyperinflation, but we have to deal with the deflation. Are they unaware of the dangers of hyperinflation, or are they prepared to deal with that?
They're not prepared to deal with anything. They're simply reacting. Remember, you know, people think that as in a chess game or any other kind of competitive game, that if someone wins, somebody loses. But you have also, in reality, is not like games. In reality, what you think is playing is a game where everybody can lose. There are no winners. And that's the kind of situation. And so what he's doing is simply playing it out and waiting for something to happen that they hope will succeed. But This particular thing, this game is not a zero sum game.
Well, given that what you've forecast, that this is a dark age, a breakdown unlike any since the 14th century, is it the case that people like Soros and people of the City of London are aware of that and they're planning to use the breakdown?
I don't think they're that intelligent. I don't think that they are using the breakdown in their own way, because Soros is essentially a thief. And he keeps stealing. He doesn't worry about what the end result is. He just keeps stealing. But no, he's also just an agent of this process. He is not actually the emperor of the universe. He's simply an agent of the British industry behind him, which are using him. No, they are not really conscious of what the end result of this process will be if it continues.
So this is sort of the pride of the oligarchy. They just assume that they'll be able to maintain control and with little regard to the consequences.
I don't think they even assume that. I think they simply, they're like animals who are fighting to death, and one will die and the other will bleed to death. They're not really thinking, in a sense. They're reacting. They're acting and reacting like an animal. This thing makes no sense. From any standpoint of calculation, any kind of calculation you can make, the whole thing makes no sense. But what you're dealing with the point of a species which rules the planet, which is no longer fit to survive. But it keeps doing. It plays out its death agony fatefully, not because it's using any kind of reason.
Well, and this grouping, the Soros grouping, tried to buy a presidential campaign or a presidential candidate with tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, much of it from the drug-pushing Nazi Soros. But now even Soros' own allies are bemoaning that they may not be in control. What's your evaluation of the incoming Obama administration, given the crisis?
I'm hesitant on posing any kind of evaluation. It's obvious that the man is not stupid. He has limitations. But I don't think necessarily he intended to do as they intended him to do. I think this is a man who he was promoted by a couple of former members of Congress, and he saw a chance to get a nomination. He was backed heavily by international British sources, including Soros, who was a key part of this. And most of this was British money, a British orchestration. So he bought the thing, in a sense. He won the presidency, in a sense, by this means. And then suddenly, once he's announced that he's won the presidency, he changes course. Maybe he's smarter than he appeared to be.
Well, I think there's a lot depending
on... But
right now,
look what he's got. He's got essentially a Clinton administration. I mean, it's not a Clinton-owned administration, but you have personalities in this, the key personalities, many of them. You have the usual clowns. Every president has a few clowns they have to put in their presidency. But he has a few of his own. But the key thing is, this is largely, as presidencies have gone recently, this is largely a very highly talented composition of what he's selected as his presidency so far. Of course, this is not confirmed yet. None of these nominations have been confirmed. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, this is a very sharp bunch of people.
Well, from November 11th to November 19th, after the election, you had a very active role in shaping the environment around the incoming president. I know that you're planning a similar series of events. In fact, I should announce that January 22nd at 1 p.m. Eastern, there will be the next international webcast, and there'll be events leading into that. What is your message to this incoming administration?
Well, my concern is since I do have a unique capability, and since many of these people know me, and many of them among them have respect for what I've accomplished and what I can accomplish, I think the prospect is that, as it stands right now, I have to be prepared to assist this administration on a number of fronts. And I'm prepared and disposed to do so.
And the fronts primarily, I assume, economics and security.
Yes, well, also, those are things that I'm very much concerned with and very obvious. But my technical or scientific skills are the ones in which I think are most crucial. Though, you know, and I also catalyze a number of things among various people. If people talk to me and so forth, and I take the product of these discussions to me into my other discussions with other people. So I am a catalytic factor in the environment as well as a direct factor.
Well, I'd like to get into the catalytic side of things then, because you and Helga just were in India recently. You had a series of public and private meetings with key people among Indian political and military elite. What's your sense of the situation in India after the Mumbai attacks, and do the leaders in India accept your idea of their role in a four-power agreement?
I would say there's a question mark there. We'll suppose that what I propose as being affirmed as a proposal from President-elect Obama, they now have received the message. If they get the actual proposal from him or from his official representatives, they will probably react favorably to it. Right now, they don't feel they're under pressure to react immediately to it. What was more of concern and a distraction in this point was the fact that the British actually staged this atrocity at Mumbai. And this, the setup of this, which we tracked out, is the British element. You have the so-called members of British lodges or British religious associations in London, in that area. Some of these are run directly by Saudi Arabia. And in all the cases of the terrorist-related operations coming from Saudi and related circles, the Saudi connection is crucial. So this is not a Pakistan operation against India, even though there were elements of the ISI and so forth, MI6's ISI and so forth, involved. But the operation was not from Pakistan as a nation, as a government. It was from people who, in part, were Pakistani in pedigree. But the operation came and directed from London. Now, the importance of this thing is that the capability that was set up to run the Mumbai operation is more serious in one sense than 9/11, because 9/11 was a one-shot operation. What was done in Mumbai could be repeated again and again and again and come from the same source, London. The problem now is that India so far has chosen to avoid confronting London on what everybody involved who's in the intelligence business knows was a British operation run through places like Dubai as well, against Mumbai. They're now playing it as if it were a Pakistan-authored operation. It is not a Pakistani-generated operation. It's a British operation run by elements in London who are of Saudi, have a Saudi pedigree, and who are running from these the association, religious organizations in London. And it's run under the protection of the Church of England, among all, the Archbishop of Canterbury. But that's how the thing is run.
And you put out a statement yesterday warning that these troop movements are very dangerous because it plays into the trap that someone could ignite something bigger. And in the same statement, you said it's time to go after the British drug networks. Now, how do these drug networks under the British domination, how do they fit into the terror?
Well, this is, again, you're dealing with a terrorist operation, which is running through things like the BAE operation, things like that. And the way it works is when they set up the operation in Afghanistan, which is an Anglo-American operation, and they recruited people through various Muslim religious groups and recruited them to go into Afghanistan as fighters against the Soviet Union. Right. This was an operation which involved Vice President George H.W. Bush and others. So it was an Anglo-American operation. Now, what happened is the Saudis used their religious training organizations and created a mechanism by which this thing was used to amplify this kind of capability. And it was the Saudi donations as charities, Saudi charities, and the charities would go to designated individuals who then could issue the honor of the money to other people they chose or institutions they chose to give it to. What would happen as a result of this, you would have perfectly legitimate Muslim organizations in London, particularly of Arab-related origin. And these Muslim organizations would then be gradually influenced by the money coming from the Saudi charity channels, so that gradually more and more of these religious bodies were taken over by Saudi choices, which were actually part of this terrorist capability. And the whole thing was protected in London by the Archbishop of Canterbury. What they did is they let the heads of these religious organizations were treated as having diplomatic status under British law. And so when the police would catch them, British police would catch them in some kind of a reason for criminal investigation, the Archbishop of Canterbury's office would step in, no, we're protecting these people. These are diplomatic figures. You cannot question them. In other words, they were given diplomatic immunities. So you had a very significant number of these organizations of people of Middle East extraction, Muslim extraction, who are perfectly decent Muslim people in London, in England. But a certain part of these guys become now a cover for these operations, and they're run by British intelligence services back and forth across the world. What they've created is a capability for using the same kind of operation they ran in Mumbai. They could run it again and again and again in various parts of the world, hit-and-run operations. So we have a new kind of international terrorist threat we have not faced before now.
And a major focus then of counter-terror must be to shut down these drug networks.
The only way, look, the British have been in the drug business in a big way since the 1790s. At that time, the British had been running the slave trade, including the people in Boston and places like that who were part of the British East India Company operation. So these guys discovered that the slave trade was not particularly profitable for them. So what they did is they gave the slave trade, particularly in the period coming out of the Napoleonic Wars, they gave the slave trade to the Spanish monarchy, the new Spanish monarchy. And the Spanish monarchy ran the African slave trade, capturing and transport. But the British, who pretended they had nothing to do with the slave trade, actually ran it. And any time the United States or some other nation would interfere with the slave trade, the British diplomatic services would step in to protect the slave traders. So then, but in this period, in the 1790s, at that point, the British shifted from two kinds of drug trade. One was opium from Turkey at that time, and the second was opium from India. And they destroyed China in a large degree through that trade. Today, the figure that's given to me is that, say, go on the border of Afghanistan. A farmer will raise a crop of a certain amount of money, and that will become have 1,000 times that value when the proceeds of that crop reach Europe. And this is the same thing as being run by Soros in the Caribbean. This is the same kind of operation as being run in Boston, Massachusetts, with the attempt to legalize the drug trade, and in the United States generally. It's what's being run in every country in South America except Colombia, which refuses to cooperate, by Soros.
You're listening to The LaRouche Show. I'm joined today by Lyndon and Helga Zepp LaRouche. And Helga, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions, and I'm very happy to have you joining your husband. I know you'll be soon celebrating an anniversary, so we'd like to give you our congratulations. But let me ask you about China, because this is a very serious situation now. Lynn was recently interviewed by two major business journals, one from mainland China and one from Taiwan. We hear stories of the collapse of exports and the effect of that. What is the situation in China right now?
Well, I think it's complicated because on the one side, we are getting reports of a really massive collapse of especially smaller and middle-level firms in the coastal area, in Guangdong, in Sichuan, in the south. So a lot of the migrant workers who were deployed in, you know, in the periphery of these firms have been laid off. And they used to send a lot of money back to their rural families, and that naturally is now stopping. So there is potentially a very, very dangerous social situation developing. On the other side, I think that even, you know, even if China is really hit very badly, we heard, for example, reports that hotels are offering gigantic, you know, rebates because of a loss of customers all of a sudden. So on the one side, the signs are really, you know, in the direction of a tremendous storm. On the other side, we have talked with people who just came back from there, and you know, somehow there's at least a certain portion of the political elite which says, well, we will sit it out together with the United States, and you know, we are not yet willing to look at it. So I think it's very dangerous, because if this collapse continues to hit, you know, I mean, the problem is the Chinese economy has been exactly that it has been so absolutely based on cheap labor, Walmart and, you know, similar productions, that if the collapse in the United States continues and in Europe, which it is, then, you know, China is facing potentially a gigantic political explosion, which, by the way, the British Sun Times had already an article about in March, by basically predicting that the Tibet operation can only really succeed in the context of a widening economic downturn in China, when you would have social unrest in many places, so that then the central government would not be able anymore to quell unrest in one or two provinces. So I think this is very bad. It's very dangerous. And, you know, I think the only hope is really, you know, what Lynn was saying earlier, that the new administration is making a significant shift, because then, you know, if, I mean, we have been told in India by many people, you know, they like what Lynn is saying, they really would like to go with it, but it has to come from the United States.
And Helga, I'd like to also ask you about Europe, because we see a fight emerging there, which is an interesting one. Even though the nations of Europe are not part of the four powers identified by Lynn, the fight there seems to be getting more intense. Your friend, the economics minister of Italy, Tremonti, is under tremendous pressure now from the pro-London faction there, the Britannia boys, who are trying to have him removed from the government. What do you see coming from Europe in the new year?
Well, I think the fight is really between, you know, the pragmatists of the European Union Commission. They are totally crazy in insisting that the stability pact of the Maastricht Agreement must be honored. And that naturally means, you know, that the new indebtedness of every country must be limited to maximum 3%, which, you know, given the fact that Greece and other places are probably reaching over 100% fairly soon in terms of total indebtedness compared to the GDP, this is not workable. And I think, you know, the people who are trying to get rid of Tremonti, who has been an outspoken proponent of new Bretton Woods policy, of the New Deal, and, you know, basically also of a bankruptcy reorganization of the system. You know, the key person right now is one of the Britannia boys, as they are called, because of their meeting at the ship Britannia in 93, where the sellout of Italy was basically agreed upon. The leader of that is presently Mario Draghi, who heads up the Financial Stability Pact. And I think we should really, ridiculize him, because he just was in Hong Kong, and there he made a speech. And I actually want to quote you some of it, because I think it's really typical and for the insanity of this faction. He said, quote, "One striking aspect of the crisis is precisely how its unfolding has continued to catch both policymakers and private sector players by surprise. It started with defaults in a marginal segment of the financial service industry, then quickly spread to virtually all assets. From being a US-only event, it has become global. None of these steps had been anticipated in a timely way by the relevant actors. And when I say in a timely way, I mean with enough lead time to permit action that could have affected the outcomes." Now, I think this is something we should really ridicule, because, first of all, you mentioned in your introductory remarks that Lin, uniquely has forecasted this this crisis, and we have the documentation to prove it. We have his webcast from the 25th of July in 2007, and all the many, many other, documentations. We have a history of having organized since 1997 for the New Bretton Woods. We had thousands of VIPs making appeals already to Clinton when he was still in office. Nobody can say that we didn't talk about this in great depth. And when this guy Draghi, claims, that the political elite was caught by surprise, it just proves that they are absolutely incapable of even saying the truth. So I think, from my personal point of view, I think that one of the most important things what we need to be doing internationally, I think in the U.S., but also in Asia and Europe, elsewhere, is to challenge people to answer the question, what was the method which allowed Lin LaRouche to make these prognoses so accurately?
Well, I think you just anticipated my next question. Because, by the way, the Draghi statement shows that he's still working for Queen Elizabeth, because the Financial Times said Queen Elizabeth said, "How come nobody saw this coming?"
Right.
Lin, I'd like to ask you about precisely the question that Helga just posed. You have a new document that's up on the website, the LaRouche PAC website, Why the Academicians Have Usually Failed in Economics. I noticed you're quite generous to the academicians by saying they've only usually failed instead of always. But you raise the point of economics as a branch of physical science. Why is that not known? Why do so few people know about the American system of economics?
Well, it's the result of British imperialism, and essentially that we've had this idea of empire and of economic systems based on imperial power. For example, the Roman Empire had a monetary policy of that type. The Byzantine Empire and so forth. With the fall of the Byzantium, about 1000 AD, about that time, then a Venetian group took over as the control of the international monetary system and ran an empire, as the Crusaders were actually working for the bankers when they were doing the funny things they were doing during that period of time, up until the 14th century. So what we have is the idea of a monetary system, which is international. It's actually controlled by private bankers, a private banking firm, such as, for example, the bankers of Venice in ancient times and still today. And then these banks, or these systems of bankers, would make agreements with the heads of governments, of states, of nations, under which, in effect, the empire was located in the international monetary system, and the kingdoms were the subjects of the agreements they made with this imperial monetary authority. Now, that tradition has been maintained, because actually, in 1763, in February, when the British Empire was created as a private empire, in the February Treaty of Paris at that point, a peace of Paris, that since that time, the Europe and the world have been dominated most of the time, except for the period where the United States was really asserting power, as especially under Roosevelt, and even a bit before that. But so we've had an empire of a monetary system which is British controlled, but not because of the people of England, but because of the national banks that run this empire, which used to be the pound sterling empire. And this empire still exists as a monetary empire. And the United States, since 1971-73, has actually been under the control of this international empire, which is called the British Empire, not because of the British people or the British Isles, but because that's the traditional name of it, and because it still has an headquarters in the Bank of England and the Queen of England as the empire. So this empire exists. And that thus people believe in the habits of thought associated with operating within a system which is an imperial system, like the Roman system or the Byzantine system or the old Venetian monitor systems. And thus they ignore the fact that there is no relationship, there's no natural relationship between prices of things in terms of money terms and actual economic value. We have to have a system of economic valuation of prices because we organize society around this agreement on these relative prices. But the system, the determination of what value is, economic value does not lie in prices as such. It lies in the value of the development of the economy. So what we have in the American system with our Constitution, where you do not allow a monetary system under our constitutional, our currency is uttered by the approval of a vote of the Congress to utter a certain amount of monetizable credit. And this is implemented then by the presidency of the United States. So there's no outside monetary agency, which controls our currency, or at least when we're functioning under our constitution. All other systems in the world, in the main, tend to be part of participation in a international monetary system, and that international monetary system is really the substance of the empire. And therefore the problem is that the people don't know their history. And because they are habituated to the idea of thinking of money as something which has a natural value, or doesn't have a natural value, but they think in those terms, and therefore they believe in this price structure, instead of realizing that we can regulate prices as we have under protectionist systems before, and we can regulate prices by an international fixed exchange rate system as we did under Franklin Roosevelt and kept that going until 1968-73.
And how would a new Bretton Woods, your new Bretton Woods, implement that?
Well, right now it means we would have to take Barney Frank and put him in a loony bin or some other place where he could safely howl all he wants to. But no more bailout. The key thing here is no more bailout. What we're going to have to do is go back and try to reconstruct what was destroyed by Barney Frank and his directors over the course of nearly a year and a half now. And we're going to have to put the whole system back into bankruptcy. And those accounts, which would qualify as chartered bank accounts previously, should be recognized as having validity. The other accounts will be put into a bankruptcy pool to see what mess we make out of them. That means we would reverse the bailout. We would go through this whole thing and reverse the bailout. We would then reconstitute the legitimate savings and other accounts of the chartered banks and put them under bankruptcy protection. If the bank as a whole were bankrupt, we would keep the doors of the bank open and we would under protection. We would also attempt to reconstruct and reestablish the valid claims of depositors and similar kinds of interests in those chartered banks, that is the state level and the federal level. And then we would have to use government credit to launch large-scale projects of development. initially largely infrastructure. We need to fix our river systems. We need to rebuild the rail system. We need to build our machine tool system back up again. We have to go into production. We have to probably do reforestation, a lot of other things that are absolutely urgently done that Roosevelt did back in the 1930s, that type of thing. And we will just have to rebuild our economy and make sure that people are taken care of, the legitimate interests are protected, that people have opportunities, that their health care is protected, and so forth and so on. And we're just going to have to put the whole thing through bankruptcy and reorganization and proceed on a basis of morality, of basic morality that any American can understand.
Well, I have a contact who is somewhat of a moral person, despite being a professional economist, and he wanted me to ask you, could you actually establish international agreements which would outlaw speculation?
Absolutely. Why not? I would do it immediately. All I need is the agreement of some powerful people to do it.
Okay. Now, I have a couple of questions sent in from members of the LaRouche Youth Movement, and Helga, the first one is addressed to you from Jenny Burns in Seattle. She wanted to know what you can tell us about the spread of youth anarchist groups. And, of course, in Seattle, that's a hotbed of these types. But also with the situation in Greece, with the threats of rioting in France and Sweden and other countries, what can you tell us about this?
Well, I think it is a definite big problem because, you know, with the culture of death, which has been increasingly dominating the so-called youth culture, and the problem of, you know, no future in a growing unemployment, in a growing sense of depression and so forth, the impact of a lot of the so-called youth culture, ranging from, you know, different varieties of pop music, which in part is outspoken satanic, to the violence of the video games, and to the spread of all kinds of, you know, synthetic ideologies, you have a new phenomena where some young people, you know, are just out to destroy things. And, you know, I think it's a new phenomena which has grown on top of previous layers and levels. And that is what is now active, because when you look at the riots in Greece, for example, you know, you had some legitimate protest of, you know, the students because of the death of this 15-year-old student. But then this was very quickly taken over by these other elements who clearly have some financing which is not legitimate at all. And therefore, you know, the thing which is really very worrisome is that with the condition of a general breakdown crisis, you know, where the trust of the population in government is in every country I know of disappearing. Because if you see these scandals, you know, like the Madoff scandal, where the former head of Nasdaq ripped off his customers by $50 billion. I mean, this is not peanuts anymore. And, you know, then you see how masses of people are losing everything. They're becoming homeless. They're being laid off. And then you have these CEOs who fill their pockets with boni, you know, of hundreds of millions of dollars. And then you have more and more the discovery that this whole thing is thievery. So the confidence of the population and naturally young people in the political class under these conditions is just completely going out of the window. Now, I think the big worry should be that if this thing is not stopped cold soon, and soon I mean really within weeks, you know, I mean the fact that there are no more reports about hunger crises, you know, it doesn't mean that they're not taking place. It just means that the collapse of the financial system has sort of taken over the front news. But, you know, if you have a continuous collapse, what I see as a big danger is that the Greek development, where you have this violence steered by certain oligarchical factions, you know, this could spread all over Europe. There is a big concern that it could spread to France, where you already have a very volatile situation in the suburbs, the so-called banlieues, you know, which already erupted a couple of times, and I think President Sarkozy is very aware of it because he took just back a very unpopular education reform, you know, not to ignite the situation further. But if you have a general collapse of the economy, you know, you could really, I have a vivid image what a dark age could look like. It's a combination of Somalia, you know, which is sort of becoming an uncharted territory, you know, where you have the disappearance of government because Somalia is just taken over by different gangs. And in Europe, you know, where you had could have a mass protest. And, you know, frankly, you know, I also remember very well the example of Albania, where you had a sort of Ponzi scheme which exploded in 1997, you know, when all the people lost all their pensions and wages and savings. And then, you know, there was unrest. People were storming supermarkets for food. But then the police and the army did not, you know, suppress that, but they participated in the storming of the supermarkets because they were hungry too. You know, so the idea which some people have concerning the use of the military domestically, you know, I know this was a discussion in the United States and in Germany it was also discussed. I think this is a very dubious prospect because if you have a general breakdown, I don't think that these kinds of measures can do anything but to, you know, heat up the situation and plunge the world further into chaos.
Well, there's a question that I'll just do a compiling from two or three different people who asked. Lynn, they said, given what Helga just described, clearly economic policy, new Bretton Woods, creation of jobs, that would bring about some optimism. But you have a nihilistic tendency in a number of youth, the problem of attention span, which you've talked about. So one person asked, how do you build this? And a second question, how do you communicate ideas? You've emphasized the role of the video work on the LaRouche Pack website with the LaRouche Youth Movement. But what is the role of music and classical drama and the interrelationship of that with an economic policy that creates optimism?
Well, that, of course, is crucial. But the other aspect is plain leadership, that we've often seen in history that when a leader of a nation or a group of leaders of a nation which find the kind of condition arising which Helga just described, and they make an appeal, which is a cogent appeal to order, the people will often rally behind them. This kind of disorder is fomented by certain interests, but you could build a counterforce against it, but this requires leadership and dedication by some people who are genuine leaders. You never have, really, I think, an absolutely hopeless situation, except in a protracted period of degeneracy. Our job is to ensure that we don't enter a protracted period of degeneracy, which means we need leadership which does not vacillate, which calls the people to defend themselves, their future, their children, their grandchildren, by acting now as a voice of sanity. And that usually will work in the early stages of such a threat. If you allow it to continue, you may get into a dark age, as we've had before. And we are within the threat of a dark age now. So those leaders who say we have to be practical, we don't do this, we don't do that, we don't take these measures, those leaders are misleaders, they're fools. Because if you don't take the measures which must be taken early, then you will get a hopeless situation. But we do not have yet a hopeless situation. If leadership appears, which is cogent, and knows how to act.
And so a related question was, someone among the youth asked if you could discuss your ideas of the music program that particularly in Boston, but also increasingly at Windy Hill. How does the study of the great classical music, Mozart, Bach, Beethoven, how does that have an effect in the population?
Well, start with the fact that most people who speak don't know how to speak. They do not know how to speak to convey ideas. They know how to speak to say, I want bread, I want love, I want meat, I want something, I want this, gimme, gimme, gimme. They know how to do that. But they don't know how to communicate ideas. For example, we have noticed in our work with the LPAC work that people can no longer, from younger generations, can in general, no longer transmit ideas by speech. They will take and pass some sentences or fragmentary sentences, which really don't mean much of anything. They're like pointing. There's no idea involved. There's the finger is pointing. There's the finger of the tongue in words is pointing. But it's not communicating ideas. We find, however, that we can get back to ideas by taking the combination of music, speech, and so forth in poetic form, vision. By combining these elements as you can with video, you can present ideas of history, actual ideas, and present them to the same audience that can't understand the ideas when they're represented by ordinary speech or ordinary writing. But when they're presented in a video medium and done artistically, when you restore cadence and other characteristics of literate speech, you find that suddenly you can take significantly large audiences can understand ideas again. So the point now is to get into this. Without music as a reference point, you can't do that. Without classical musical composition, singing, choral work, so forth, without that, you cannot develop literate speech. And therefore, the purpose of singing is to be able to communicate ideas, not simple to utter words.
And well, I would like to add only one thing, and that is there is this spiritual, in it is this line, I sing because I'm happy. And that is a very important thing, because singing makes you happy.
Well, Helga, I'd like to ask you also in a follow-up to that. This coming year will be the 250th anniversary of Friedrich Schiller's birth. I'm wondering if you have any ideas or plans for a year of Schiller.
Well, you know, we have here a lot of young people who are quite enthusiastic about Schiller. And, you know, the idea is basically that we will have the production of lots of articles that we have since many years, actually since decades, we have in our newspaper in Germany the title Nun kommt die Schillerzeit, which means now comes the times of Schiller, meaning, you know, a renaissance of, you know, classical culture. So we basically think to use this 250th anniversary to, you know, really present the entirety of the works of Schiller, have all the youth write articles so that we every week have one major article, you know, on different aspects of Schiller's work. Plus we plan to have performances, recitations, and, you know, I mean, obviously using this to bring in the whole discussion of, you know, what wonderful cultural tradition this period really was, because when you had the classical composers, which you just mentioned, from Bach to, you know, Brahms, and even Hugo Wolf has written a couple of beautiful songs. I mean, that was the same period when Schiller lived, and a lot of other great thinkers, you know, also in science and so forth. So it will be a forum to really celebrate, you know, the ideas of this period.
Well, we're also coming up on the 200th anniversary of Lincoln's birth. And Lynn, when you were speaking of the question of leadership, clearly Lincoln understood this principle of poetry. If you read some of his great speeches, it's clear that he sort of exemplified what Shelley meant when he talked about poets being the unacknowledged legislators.
Well, all great thinkers, Franklin Roosevelt his own way, also, any person who is a great person has a sense of poetic expression. a musical poetic expression, and it's classical music poetic expression. And this is the mark which you recognize even going into a room sometimes. You recognize that here's someone who is a thinker, because of the manner in which they express ideas. And this was obviously the case with Abraham Lincoln, and it was also the case largely with Franklin Roosevelt. Franklin Roosevelt's cadences, his manner of speaking, the way he formulated ideas, were an essential part of his power as a leader, just as Lincoln more significantly, of course, but Roosevelt had much the same tradition.
Now, there one more question from two youth movement members. Lynn, I'd like you to take this up, and Helga, if you have some thoughts, but it's from Jason Bustani in Los Angeles and Anthony Guerrero from Seattle. They want to know about the direction of the LaRouche youth movement, and Anthony in his message wrote, he said, I know I won't be a youth much longer, so I want to see what your thinking is as to where the youth movement is headed and what we should be thinking about in our own development.
I think the development is the name of it, but the development is never abstract in the sense of being timeless or outside of history. Development always occurs in terms of a response to an historical process, and it may be a response to a past part of history, in the sense you're trying to bring it back. It may be a response to the current conditions to present an idea which is necessary, but always it's an attempt to convey real ideas. And in this time, the problem is we live in a period of complete sophistry. Our culture, English language culture today in the United States, is sophistry. You look at the greatest leaders, compare it with the 18th century or compare it with the 19th century, like Lincoln, for example. You had people who actually could express ideas, and you had great music and great composers. Today, you have people who cannot express ideas. They express a jumble of words, or they make sounds like chimpanzee grunts and screams, which they call music. So it's lost. And the first purpose is to develop the ability to express ideas. Express them, yes, in a persuasive way, because that's important, but also to get people to suddenly see a vision of an idea. It's what the great poet does, what the great musician does, the great composer.
And Helga, did you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think this vision thing is important. No, I'm saying it because, you know, we had here the 90th birthday of the former Chancellor Helmut Schmidt, who did a couple of useful things, but unfortunately also he is famous for having said that people who have visions belong to a psychiatric asylum. And that is exactly, you know, this problem of the practical, reasonable man. And I think, you know, the challenge for the youth movement right now, I think internationally, is there is a tremendous vacuum. The sophistry is breaking down, and the fact that the neoliberal paradigm, which was associated with this globalization, is really finished. And you don't have yet everybody understanding that, and not everybody is acknowledging it, but it will become pretty clear that you need a complete different set of thinking, of axioms, of philosophical foundations, and to shape that, you know, and to determine what should be the new paradigm and what should be, you know, the philosophical ideas which replace this past neoliberal disaster. You know, in a certain sense, it's on a world scale what happened, or rather what did not adequately happen when the communist system collapsed in 1989 to 91. You know, there a system collapsed, communism failed, and, you know, basically there was a vacuum, and then the free market ideology just sneaked in. But now the free market is collapsing, and therefore, you know, either it's a dark age or it's a renaissance, and I think, you know, I'm an optimist in so far as I know that you know, a lot of people are so freaked out about what could happen that there is also a tremendous energy and desire by a lot of forces around the world to say we need a new paradigm for civilization, you know, which puts this oligarchy behind us forever. And, you know, I have said many times I'm really hopeful that, you know, the people in a couple of years will look back at this present conjuncture, 2008, 2009, and say this was really the low point where the dark age was looming, but then people recognizing the danger got their act together, you know, and put a new renaissance instead. And this time, you know, ending oligarchism as a childhood disease, you know, where people will laugh about after a while and say, how could people be so foolish to chase after money? How could they waste their entire life by speculating in the internet or elsewhere, you know, for something which then turned out to be just virtual and didn't exist? And how did they waste their lives and did not really pursue a creative life, which is much more joyous and much more, you know, giving you much more in reward. Much more rewarding.
Well, you've been listening to Lyndon LaRouche and Helga Zepp LaRouche in our year-end program for 2008. On behalf of the LaRouche Show and all your friends around the world, I'd like to thank you for joining us today and also wish you a happy anniversary, and let's make 2009 the year of victory for humanity. On January 22nd at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, this will be the next webcast. This is something which should have the largest audience ever coming 2 days after the inauguration of a new administration. There'll be other activities leading into that. Keep tuned to the LaRouche PAC website for updates, and also virtually daily, in fact, sometimes several times a day, there are 3 to 6 minute video updates on LaRouche PAC TV. And let me conclude by urging our listeners to contribute to make sure that 2009 will be a year of victory. You can give us a call at 800-929-7566. That's 800-929-7566. So Lynn and Helga, thank you very much for joining us today.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.